Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Deeper Waters podcast. I am Nick Peters. For those of you who have been wondering, my week has gone well. As you know, last Saturday was a question of whether or not I'd be able to make it since I was having some health issues. I'm functioning, I'd say. There's still probably a lot of adjusting and such I'm having to make, but I'm making it. I'm fully functional. Looking at me, you wouldn't know I'd gone through anything. Now, today we've got an interesting show lined up. We're going to be talking about women. Yeah, but not the way you think. We're going to be talking about women in the world of the New Testament. And in order to do that, I asked a female scholar to come on and talk with me about this topic, and that's Lynn Kowick. And she's got a very impressive resume here. She's a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois. She has a B.A. in Bible and Religion, graduated summa cum laude from Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania, and a Ph.D. in New Testament Christian Origins from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, several books. She's written commentaries on Philippians and Ephesians. She's written Women in the World of the Earliest Christians, New Testament in Antiquity, and the Peripatia attributed to Melito of Sardis, Setting Purpose and Sources, and my apologies if I butchered that title. She's written several book chapters. She's written several articles in peer-reviewed journals, including Virginity Unveiled, Tertullian's Veiling of Virgins, and Historical Women in the First Three Centuries A.D., several pieces and articles in popular writing, several dictionary articles, numerous reviews. She's under contract for some books, Christian Women of the 2nd through 6th Centuries, and Ephesians and New International Commentary of the New Testament, given a number of public addresses, member of the Institute for Biblical Research, the Society of Biblical Literature, North American Patristic Society, and the ETS. And there is a lot here, a number of professional committees. It would take a while to go through all this, but she's my guest today. So, Dr. Kowick, welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast.
Thank you so much, Nick. I'm happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you here. Now, I've given quite a bit of your CV here, but how is it that you're able to be doing what you're doing today?
Yeah, so I think if you had said to me when I graduated from college that about 30 years later I'd be where I am, I'm not sure I would have predicted that. It's been quite an exciting ride, but I think what I have loved most is that I actually get paid for doing research and exploration on the biblical text, and that's just the best possible thing as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. There aren't usually a lot of women in academia today, so what got you interested in it?
Well, I originally had wondered if I would want to go into medicine. I come from a family of doctors and nurses, so I thought maybe I would do that. But I also really enjoyed teaching, and so in the first and second year of my undergrad, I was an education major, and then truth be told, I worked at a camp, a playground camp kind of thing the summer of my sophomore year of college and realized I just don't have what it takes to work with elementary age kids. My hat goes off to those who can, but it did not play to my strengths. But I do love to teach, and I love studying the Bible. I love studying the history, the people of the Bible, and so I thought, well, let me pull those things together and teach at a college level.
Okay. Well, since we're talking about the way women were in the ancient world, it could be good to contrast it to what we see today, because in today's society, men and women in many ways are seen as equal. They can do the same kinds of jobs. They can both vote. They can both own property, can drive cars, things of that sort. But right before we came on, I was thinking that I've got many, many books from the ancient world. I can't think of one, though, right now, that's written by a woman. I can think of several about women, but not one that's by a woman. And you hold a position of teaching today at a university. And in the ancient world, that kind of be unheard of, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah, there are a number of differences between our representative democracy, the high level of education that we have in the United States, the strong middle class. Those are things that didn't exist in the ancient world. And so if we want to talk about the first century, which is a time when the Roman Empire was expanding, one of the things that's interesting, maybe slightly counterintuitive until we think about it, is that monarchy actually can allow for women to have a voice. Now, only a few women, but it would be the emperor's wife or the emperor's mother or cousin. In other words, there were some very powerful women in the first century. And actually, the couple centuries before the imperial period, when you had the Roman Republic and you also had certain kingdoms like the kingdom of the Ptolemies, whose most famous queen we all know, that's Cleopatra. She was probably the most wealthy woman at her time. And Alexandria, her capital city, was light years ahead of Rome. And she wasn't representative of all women, but it's an example of women who held tremendous power and authority by virtue of their being a queen or queen mother or the wife of the emperor. So you have that we don't have today in the United States. You don't have, when you mention about me being a professor, you do have women who have learned philosophy at this time. But I think to a person, they were taught this by their husbands or by their fathers. And we don't have examples of women then establishing their own schools. So you're correct to say that there's a lot of discontinuity between how we experience men and women interacting today and how they would have experienced it in the ancient world.
And we'll be getting into a lot of that as well. So let's go to the time of the first century. And let's suppose you were a Gentile living in the Roman Empire and you were a woman. What would your average life be like?
Well, I think to talk about that fully, you'd have to tell me how much money I was making. And that's probably true a little bit today in the United States as well. What is my race? What is my socioeconomic status? If you want to put me as a shopkeeper in Philippi, then I would be working alongside my husband in the shop baking bread or selling fruit, and we would be scratching by with probably, a couple of days' wages maybe saved, you know, that we wouldn't be starving, but we'd be able to just kind of make it. If I lived out in a rural setting, I'd be doing an awful lot of the farming or the gardening, caring for the livestock. I think both men and women at this time, the vast majority were at a subsistence level, basically. And so everybody worked, and very few people had any leisure time.
Okay, let's suppose we moved up a little bit. Instead of being lower class, suppose you're middle class, but you don't have to work for a time, but you're not upper class yet. You're just kind of in the middle. What's your life like then?
Well, they really didn't have something like that. I think that's the huge difference between our time and their time. You had the elite, and then a very small retainer class, like scribes, let's say, who worked directly with a senator, for example, from the Roman Senate. Or let's say you were of the equestrian order, which was just under the Senate, and you were, a wife of a general, and your husband was stationed in Britain. We do have a letter, actually, a birthday invitation of such a woman who was married to a commanding officer, and she sends a letter to one of her friends there, also in Britain, inviting her to come and celebrate a birthday. It doesn't appear that this woman would have done any kind of work in terms of, you know, putting food on the table. And it doesn't really, we can't really say from the invitation, you know, what, how she kept herself busy during the day. But I would imagine she still would have had lots of responsibilities in terms of running the house, making sure there was enough food for whoever was coming in terms of visitors and that sort of thing. So, I think seeing her as running the household, managing the slaves, managing the servants, that's probably what she would be doing.
And then we can wrap it off. If you were upper class, so what I mean, you're up there with the nobility and such, what's your life like?
Well, yes, if I was going to travel back in time, that's for sure where I'd want to land. I think from what we can tell, you had enough leisure time that you were able to pursue writing, and you could read books. So we have some evidence that, like a woman philosopher who composed several books, we don't have those any longer, but there's a record that that's what she did. So if it was someone like me, and assuming that I had my same interests, I would be able to take advantage of those by learning philosophy and writing or reading or composing poetry, maybe doing art for art's sake, not necessarily as an artisan or an actor, but just for its own sake, painting, and I would have the leisure time to do that.
You can correct me if I'm wrong on this, since you're the expert, of course, but I understand also that women who were married, which would be most of them back then, that marriages weren't really for love, and that a lot of times the wife would be the person the husband would have children with, but not necessarily even his favorite partner. Is that accurate?
Yes, parts of that, absolutely. I think we do have a number of spontaneous, if you will, expressions of love that a husband gives to his wife. And you even have stylized references to the beloved wife on a tombstone that the husband sets up that indicate, I mean, they'll use the word love. The husbands will talk about how much they value their wife. But what they are valuing in their wife and what they see as lovable characteristics wouldn't necessarily be the same sorts of things that we would think of today. So her quietness, her almost what we might think of today as her passivity. Also, she was loved for her industriousness, working the loom to make sure that the family had clothes, and also very much praised for her modesty and keeping her marriage vows. when the husband took his marriage vow, so to speak, he promised that he would take care of her, so to speak, that he wouldn't let her clothes go threadbare or her shoes wear out or not feed her or those kinds of things. But it was never the case that he would pledge a monogamous relationship only with her. So to your point that you mentioned earlier, he might have, it wouldn't be a problem for him to go to a local brothel, for example. That would not be seen as rejecting the marriage vows if you were a Gentile. If you were Jewish, that would be a different story. And we have some Gentile writings that make fun of Jewish men for not going to brothels. So it's probably the case that here's a difference you have between a Gentile view of normal sexual expression and a Jewish view of the same.
It's interesting when you're talking about the way that a woman would be praised. Pardon me, for that sounds in some ways like Proverbs 31 woman as well, because she's praised for working around the house, for keeping things up, for making sure her children are provided for contending for her husband at the gate, and things like that. So could the Jews have also shared some of those same similarities with their Gentile brothers?
Yes, and I think that's very true, and I think a lazy man was a man who was looked down upon, which Proverbs also talks about. And I think part of the reason both men and women were praised for being industrious is that there was so much work that needed to be done. And there was only so much, you know, let's say you had one field and you had to plant and harvest that field. And if you were lazy, then the field didn't get harvested well. But that was all that the village had to eat with. You know, it was a zero-sum game. It was only one pizza pie, and it wasn't like the different economic systems we have today. And so a lazy person meant that the whole community was impacted negatively. So I think someone who didn't work was someone who dragged down the whole community. And Paul talks about that certainly in Thessalonians.
And I'm also thinking that this is because they were, in fact, usually day wage earners. And if after this show, for instance, I wanted to go and fix myself, say, a sandwich, I just go get a couple of pieces of bread off top of the fridge, put some peanut butter or cheese on it, and there, I'm done. Now, if you live in the ancient world, said, I want some bread. Well, you go out there and you meet the fowl and everything else for 3 hours, and then all of a sudden you've got what you want.
Exactly. Yeah. That. And so I think that just the amount of time that it took to put the food from when you gathered it to when you put it on the table, it's just incredible and so very different from how most of us today. In the United States, at least, not so much in other parts of the world. In other parts of the world, their rhythm of life does have a lot of parallels with the Old and New Testament way of life.
Well, we're coming up on our first break. We've talked a lot about Gentiles. We've gotten a little bit into Jewish views on women. So we're going to discuss that a bit more when we come back. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Lynn Kerwick from Wheaton. We're talking about women in the New Testament world. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back. My guest is Lynn Kerwick from Wheaton College. We're talking about women in the New Testament world. If you have a question about women in the New Testament world, our number is 714-242-5180. Now, we talked about Gentiles quite a bit, but when we go to the Jews, now they've got their Hebrew Bible there with them. It's got men and women both equally in the image of God. We've got two books named after women, Ruth and Esther, in there, so surely the Jews would have a high view of women. What's the reality? How was your life if you were a Jewish woman?
Well, I think you're right. They had a high view of women. If we allow for the general culture of the day, when we started this conversation and you mentioned about men and women vote, well, of course, you know, that wasn't the case in the ancient world, actually for a lot of men also. I mean, we want to make sure that we don't try and evaluate the first century world from our own parameters, at least at the detail level. But broadly speaking, Jews did value women very much. I'll give an example that contrasts this with Gentiles. As you're probably aware, there was a practice among Gentiles of infanticide. After a child was born, it wasn't always understood that you would raise that child. If it physically deformed, or if you just decided that your family didn't have the financial resources, then you would put the child out, either out on the hillside where it was sure to perish, or take it somewhere in the village or the town where it seems like babies were left and then picked up to be raised by someone else as their slave. We have no record at all of Jews doing that practice. And that practice of infanticide affected women much more than men. That is to say, baby girls were put out more than baby boys. We don't have that practiced at all in Judaism because of, as you say, they saw men and women made in the image of God. And so I would say from that standpoint, there is, a equal valuing. Second, I would say that within the first century world, Jesus' world, you have examples of women following particular, either a particular teacher or a particular group, even one that might not be followed by their husband. So, for example, you have women who follow Pharisaic practices while their husbands follow Sadducee practices. You have women who have joined the Essenes, which is a group not specifically mentioned in the New Testament by name, but they're the group that produced what we call now the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they were started by somebody called the Teacher of Righteousness back maybe in the 200s BC. And they were a very ascetic group, a very strict group, very stringent. And women, according to their own sectarian writings, women joined that group. So you had the possibility within Judaism of women following their conscience, if you will. I mean, nobody ever describes it quite that way, but that's, I think, what we see happening as women are encouraged to embrace their Jewish faith.
That really surprised me when you said that about the Essenes, because I'd been under the impression that the Essenes were a purely male society.
Yes, well, and at the site at Qumran that's been excavated and that most scholars believe was a community of celibate males who then put all of the texts, the biblical texts, the sectarian texts, the extra-biblical texts there in the caves nearby, that group, for the most part, people believe was a celibate-only male group. But when you read the actual writings of the sect, it appears that you had even married couples, families, and this evidence is corroborated by Josephus, who is a first-century historian, Jewish historian, who also describes a subset, if you will, of Essenes who lived in the town and raised families. So those two bits of information held together suggest that there were women who joined the group.
Well, we won't stay on the topic of Essenes because also my guest next week would be discussing, I'm going to be talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls next week, but since you brought up Josephus, I think it is when ask you about this reference that's in Josephus, and it's in the Antiquities of the Jews in 4.8.15. But let not a single witness be credited, but three or two at the least, and those whose testimony is confirmed by the good lives. But let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex, nor let servants be admitted to give testimony on account of ignobility of their soul, since it's probable that they may not speak truth either out of hope of gain or fear of punishment. So what are we supposed to do with Josephus' attitudes towards women? Was he normal for the time, or was he out of sync, or what?
No, I think he was pretty normal for this time. I think that while he would not have denied that women are made in the image of God, he also, as many did, most did at this time, held to Aristotle's biology, if you will. And Aristotle argued that women were, in a sense, kind of a not fully formed human, if you will, that the male was the perfect and the female was the imperfect. And so what you read there, Josephus is expressing, I think, the view in terms of like how they would see their science or how they would understand what's natural. You look at a woman, she's smaller, she can't lift as much. She must be inferior. And it also grew from there. She's inferior in terms of her capacity to think and witness. So, yeah, and that would have been true in the world of the Jews and the world of the Gentiles. The whole Hellenistic world would have held that view. And they would have also recognized exceptions to that. Today a lot of times people will say, oh, doctors are only in it for the money. Then when you ask them about their particular doctor, oh, they love their doctor. He or she is the smartest and loves people and, you know, would do it for free. And so I think when you have writings like what you quoted there, where he's speaking in the abstract and very general, I think that I'm not denying that there's that belief at this time. But then when you look at, well, how would he have interacted with individual women? And would he have been as dismissive of them as what his words sound like? Probably not the case. As he talks about certain women that he meets, he can be very favorable to them. And if I can just expand a little bit more, I think one of the things that your question touches on, and I handle this in my book, Women in the World of the Earliest Christians, I set out when I wrote that book to write a chapter on marriage and then a chapter on being a daughter and being a mother and working and the religious life, just sort of the average life of a woman, Gentile or Jew. What I realized was that as I got into the chapter on marriage, I realized I had to make it two chapters, one on marriage ideals that are talked about and the other looking at the realities of marriage, because a lot of times they don't line up, and we have to be careful we don't assume the kind of rhetoric, abstract statements of a Josephus or others accurately reflect everything that happens day to day on the ground. Sometimes you get a different shading or shadowing when you look at what's actually happening day in and day out.
Yeah, I'm thinking me for an example of that. I have given talks before on love and marriage somewhere, and I would love to be able to say, and I follow what I teach perfectly and wonderfully, and we never have conflict at our house, and my nose would be growing as I was saying that at that point. So expand on that some. What was the idea for marriage as a Jew, and what was the normal reality?
Well, so I think the ideal, as maybe presented by an Aristotle or others, was that the husband ruled and had final say, and had what needs took priority over the wife's needs and and desires. And so you have a very asymmetrical relationship. And that was somewhat established also in law. Adult women could not defend themselves in court or sign papers. They always needed to have a guardian, a male guardian sign for them. So there were certain ways in which society, in a legal sense, also reinforced their sort of junior status, if you will. And so that there is that reality that is happening and is kind of codified in the philosophical writings. But when you look at the fact that men and women, husbands and wives, work together, you can see it in certain art reliefs or in the letters that they send back and forth, that they worked side by side with each other, that they relied on each other. As I mentioned earlier, there are testimonies of a husband's great love for his wife. For example, one couple, this is a Gentile couple, but I'll give a Jewish example in a moment, where you have a husband and wife who do not have children, and the wife said, well, you could divorce me and marry someone else, and that way you would have a child. And the husband writes back, he would never even consider doing that. You know, why would he change what is so good for something unknown and potentially not very fulfilling? You also have with Philo, who's a first century, but early in the first century Jewish writer, who talks about how he would encourage, even if a couple doesn't have children, but they're happy together, that no one suggests either divorce or a second wife, you know, a polygamy. That seemed to be practiced at least on a minority, in a minority way by Jews. It was not practiced by Romans. But at any rate, Philo, the bottom line for Philo is, if it's a happy couple, even if they don't have children, it's still a good marriage. So I think in that, those are some of the sort of real situations that come up with marriage that I think indicate a companionship of sorts, although not, again, the kind of, you know, nobody married their best friend. How we like talk like that today, their soulmate. That wasn't the goal in the ancient world. But you could have a love, for sure, as they saw that, a love and a companionship.
Back when I was doing some reading with answering a question yesterday, and did some reading the Old Testament law in Exodus, and it was striking me how much the women were to be taken care of. There were special rules for women in most any situation that didn't apply to the men, including that if a man married another wife, he was still to make sure that the first one got food, clothing, shelter, and her conjugal rights still.
Yes, yes. And in the time of the first century, you very rarely do you have polygamy. We do have an example of one case of that in what's known as the Babatha archives, which are an early second century find that is connected with the revolt of 132 to 135 called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. At any rate, in this collection of documents from Babatha, she is the second wife. And we have, it's actually kind of a fascinating read to see how she loaned some money to this to her husband. She presumably married for love, because, and he married her for love because she already had a son. She had been married before and her husband died, but she had a son. There was no reason in terms of wanting children that she would need to remarry, but she did. And she loaned this new husband some money for a dowry for his daughter to marry. And then, unfortunately, that husband died, so her second husband dies, and his first wife, Miriam, and Babisa are in conflict about who gets what, and Babisa wants her loan paid, and so tries to take some of his property as payment for that loan that she made. So it's, you know, that's what I say, that once you start getting into some of the documents and the letters, and you read some of the inscriptions, the world of the first century just comes alive, and you realize it's very complicated, like our own world today is complicated.
Yeah, and what about the topic of divorce as well? Because I understand that normally only men could initiate divorce, but there are some exceptions that we find that some kings and their wives that women could initiate, but there was one school, and I always get them confused. I know about the schools of Shammai and the school of Hillel. One of them said divorce only in the case of adultery. The other one said, if your wife burns your toast in the morning, you can't divorce her. So what was the attitude towards divorce then?
Yes, well, I think, and we can turn to Matthew 19, for example, where that, I think, that conversation is central. I think what those two Pharisaical schools, Shammai and Hillel, they're both Pharisees. Shammai was more the, we might say, letter of the law, and Hillel was a little more, what should we say, flexible or expansive in their reading. And when they looked at Deuteronomy 24, they were trying to understand what the Hebrew was saying and whether the Hebrew was allowing for two different reasons for divorce or one. So and the Shammites were saying it's one reason for divorce, namely marital unfaithfulness, which would have probably been primarily seen as adultery. And then the Hillites said, no, though there's actually two reasons that are given here, adultery and if the husband is no longer attracted to his wife. And then I think what you're referring to about the burnt toast, so to speak, is the a later rabbi commenting on the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai in this regard. But it's and he does say something to the effect of, well, if you go with the Hillelite view, well, then you could divorce a wife for burning your supper. But it's not really clear that he means that as a declarative statement or if he's being ironic. That is to say, he might be criticizing the Hillelites by saying, look, if we go with your path, well, then my goodness, men could even divorce for the ridiculous reason of a wife not preparing the supper well. So I think I think that's the overall context of that. I think what amazes me so much about that discussion there in chapter 19 of Matthew is the disciples' response. They seem to be very surprised that Jesus would restrict a husband's prerogative to divorce to something so narrow, apparently, as adultery. And they say, well, then it'd be better never to marry. And it just surprises me that I think the disciples are reflecting the wider position at this time, which seemed to be pretty comfortable with divorce. Now, I don't know if divorce happened a lot. Again, it gets back to rhetoric. I think there are times when you'll have a Greek historian or something make a comment about, you know, oh, this woman, she's been divorced 8 times this year or something ridiculous. He's just trying to make a point, not stating a historical fact. But I do think that divorce was certainly a possibility. But when you divorced, you had to give your wife her dowry back unless you could prove that she was unfaithful in her marriage vows. And so I think that there was a reason for a husband and wife to be serious before they married, and not just enter something lightly, because there was certainly the dowry that had to be considered.
Well, we're going to take a break for now. We're back. We'll be asking a bit more questions, particularly about Jesus, since he's been brought into the picture now. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Lynn Kerwick from Wheaton College. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back to the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Lynn Kerwick from Wheaton College. We're talking about Jesus and women, or just women in the New Testament world. But let's start talking about Jesus. How was Jesus' attitude towards women in comparison to the attitude of the average Jew of his day?
I think that Jesus welcomed women. And I, when saying that, I'm not implying that all other Jewish men at this time did not welcome women. But I think Jesus did, and I think some of his welcoming of women was tied to his claims about purity and impurity, or cleanness and uncleanness. In Jesus' ministry, he stressed how it's not what you eat that makes you unclean, but that what you say, you know, that comes from your heart, that's what makes you unclean. And one of the, how that impacts women's lives is that at this time in other groups, like, for example, we mentioned the Essenes, or, and you also mentioned Josephus, he'll talk about this, and it's in the Old Testament, right? The purity codes, especially the menstrual purity codes and the childbirth purity codes, based somewhat on the menstrual purity codes, that govern women's lives and restrict women's movements into the city of Jerusalem and certainly into the temple area, given whether they're clean or unclean. It's interesting to me that in the New Testament we don't have any mention at all of any of the women disciples. It never comes up. Nobody asked Jesus this question. We have women who follow Jesus around. That's mentioned in Luke 8, 1 through 3. So you have women and men that are together, and Jesus never talks about that aspect of the woman's life. And so I'm now just supposing here, because it's an argument from silence, but it's just intriguing to me and interesting to me. I would think then that the women would have reacted to Jesus, differently at least. I'm not saying that Jewish women felt the menstrual purity codes to be a burden for them, but it certainly would have changed how they would have thought about themselves if they could have accessed God, their prayers be heard, and all of that, regardless of their state of purity. So that would be one area where I think Jesus's interaction with women would have been very different from any other Jewish man at this time. And let me also then just add that I think not only is Jesus good for women, that is to say, he saw them as individuals and as spiritual seekers, he also saw men that way. And I think that's, and he saw the outcast and the needy with a special compassion. And so I think for those who saw those qualities in Jesus and were attracted to those, he was a very appealing figure.
And what about how he handled women of less noble character. In fact, my own pastor Wednesday night was somewhere when we were talking about the Luke 7 story where Simon the Pharisee throws a party and in comes this prostitute suddenly just barging in with all these theologians there and starts washing Jesus' feet with her hair and crying. A woman, Simon's getting indignant, and Jesus is too, but it's not with the woman. He's getting indignant with Simon. And now, how is that for Jesus? He's incredibly revolutionary right there, isn't he?
Yes, he certainly takes Simon to task for failing to provide the minimum level of hospitality that should have been granted to any of his guests. I think what is interesting to me in that dialogue also is that Simon is thinking Jesus can't really be a prophet because he doesn't know who's touching him. And he certainly wouldn't have allowed himself to be touched by a woman of her sort. And I think it's quite telling, especially when you read the whole story of Luke. Simon is condemned in at least two ways. First, by not overtly being hospitable to Jesus, but also failing to see that the purposes of God are for those who have to reach out to those who don't have. And so Simon is critiqued in the narrative in both of those ways. Presumably, Jesus had already spoken to this woman, and she accepted his message and is following after him. He eats with tax collectors and sinners, as Luke tells us. And so I don't want to minimize the shock, perhaps, that Simon felt or the disgust that Simon felt at Jesus allowing a woman who at least previously was a prostitute, presumably she's changing her occupation now. But I think also the fact that he hangs out with tax collectors is as repulsive to someone like a Simon who would see a tax collector as a collaborator with Rome and as an apostate to the Jew. So not to minimize your point, but just to expand it a little bit and say that I think we have equal examples of Jesus reaching out to those that were rejected, men and women, that were rejected by the keepers of the law, so to speak, the ones who controlled the towns.
When we get to Luke 10 later on in the chapter, Jesus is at the home of Mary and Martha, and Martha's working away in the kitchen or doing the task, making sure everything's ready, and Mary's sitting at Jesus' feet listening to him, and she gets angry and says, "Jesus, won't you make her do what she's supposed to do?" And Jesus replies, "Martha, to correct her." What's going on there exactly, and how unusual is Jesus' behavior in this case?
Yes, that's a passage that, there's layers to it, isn't it? It's complicated, and people don't always agree on specifically what's going on, because at the end of the day, we all love Marthas because they get the job done. I mean, we have to be honest. We love the Marthas, and we wish Jesus really hadn't been quite so harsh on her. I think what would be important to know as we explore that story is that Martha and Mary have brought Jesus to their home. They are the hosts. And unlike Simon a few chapters earlier, who failed to treat Jesus with the proper hospitality, Martha is very concerned that hospitality take complete control of the situation. And so she asks Jesus, aren't you concerned here for our family's social honor? Shouldn't Mary be out here helping me, doing the kinds of things that a good host does when they have a guest of your caliber in their midst? Because, of course, nobody's going to eat if Martha's not getting something ready, or if they have, you know, some other people who are helping her, if, I don't know, you know, a younger girl from the village is helping as a, you know, I don't know that Mary and Martha had slaves, but there may have been other people around in the village that would have, women that would have been helping. But especially if it's only Martha and Mary, and the protocol for hospitality being what it is, I think Martha is asking Jesus to reinforce the hospitality codes that govern their social world. And no one's going to eat unless Martha puts it on the table. And it's going to take a lot longer if it's just Martha putting it on the table. So I think Jesus, in rebuking Martha's attitude here, is doing more than simply talking about women's work. I think he is trying to challenge the protocols of the day that work against following him. So for another example, when a man comes to Jesus and says, I'm going to follow you, but first let me bury my father. And Jesus says, no, let the dead bury their own dead. You come and follow me now. That most likely what that man was referring to is his responsibility to stay at his house until his father died. Presumably his father's alive, is working and all that. He stays with the family households, and when his father dies, he gives him a proper burial, and then he's free, quote unquote, to go and follow after God. And Jesus says, I'm not going to support that way of understanding your social responsibilities. I come first. So what he said to that man and what he said in the situation with Mary, I think it's consistent. And here's where we get back to your earlier question of how did Jesus understand women. I think the greatest compliment anyone can give another person is asking them to be serious about their faith and treating them as a serious disciple. And I think that's what you see Jesus doing here with Mary. He does the same thing in John's gospel with Martha as they talk about resurrection. And he confirms and approves her understanding of resurrection and then takes it further to identify himself as resurrection and the life. So these are clearly two educated women, and Jesus affirms that.
Well, we've got someone, looks like, who's called in. Would you like to take a question from a caller?
Sure.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air of Dr. Lynn Kowick.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Fine.
Well, hey, I just wanted to read my, I just started listening to you guys. I think you're really great. I wanted to read just my favorite Bible verse, if that was okay.
Okay.
All right, it's Timothy 2:11-15. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not then deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became the sinner. But woman will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety.
Well, Dr. Kowick, we were going to be discussing these verses later on, but looks like it's come up right now. What do you think about this passage?
Yes, well,
I don't believe it. I wasn't trying to be, you know, disrespectful or condescending. I wanted to know what you thought of these passages, too.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, so tongue-in-cheek, I would say that, fortunately, because I have two children, I am safe. That's supposed to be my attempt at a joke. But it is, in fact, if we start in verse 15, which I will get back up there. But woman will be saved, sozo, you know, so the verb salvation that Paul uses elsewhere, we normally understand to be saved if she has children. Of course, we know that that particular way of understanding the verse is silly. But it does, I think, alert us to the where Paul goes at the end here. And what he says at the end...
it's pretty terrible.
How do you mean?
It's degrading towards women.
Yes, I think... Well, yes, depending on how the how it's been interpreted, I think you're absolutely right. It has been used as a bludgeon And I think that...
I don't think it's how it was interpreted. I mean, I've read the Bible many times. I went to Catholic school my entire life. I've read this many different translations and versions before. And I guess I'm wondering, why would you worship a book that treats people this way?
Yes, well, I worship God, not the book. The book is our way of trying to understand who this, or as we read the book, try to interpret who this God is. But your point still stands, and that is God's character is reflected in the Bible, and in this particular verse, there are others, but this particular verse seems to fly in the face of what we think of as a loving God. And so what do we do with it? Well, I would say a couple of things. Unfortunately, the English translations, all of them struggle with how to interpret some of the words that are there and also capture the tense meanings or the ways that the verbs can be understood. Secondly, they tend not to appreciate that this is a letter and thus has a particular focus addressing a particular situation, which, since it's the Word of God, also applies to us. But we have to first understand what that original situation in Ephesus is, as Paul writes to Timothy. And then finally, that what would be the wider, not just within the Christian community, but what's going on in the wider community in Ephesus, which you're probably aware, that's where the Temple to Diana is, one of the largest temples, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And her worship certainly would have impacted just the city itself, and then by extension, Christians would be differentiating themselves from that worship. So when I look at things, for example, I would start at chapter 1 of 1 Timothy and note that some of the men are teaching things that are endless genealogies, for example, is one of the phrases used. And most likely that means that there are some people in Ephesus who are exploring ideas, probably syncretistic ideas that later become full-blown Gnostic heresies that we have in the early second century. And those writings that we do have preserved, recently discovered and also preserved in the Church Fathers, those writings stress that Eve was not deceived, but rather was the heroine of the story, and they teach some other things. But to me, when you realize that there are ideas floating around at this time that would say that Eve was not deceived and that she didn't sin, but rather she revealed or exposed the Creator God as a secondary kind of God, well, then I think anybody who's teaching that should not teach. And if somehow that's what's going on, saying that Eve was not deceived, well, then it is correct for Paul or anyone to ask that person to stop teaching that. And Paul says that, I think, to the men at the beginning of the letter in chapter 1, where those men who stylize themselves as teachers but go off about endless genealogies, that's also most likely this sort of proto-Gnostic ideas floating around. So I would say in that case, what Paul says about women, he also says about men. If you're teaching something wrong, you need to stop. Secondly, in that passage that you read, Paul starts by saying, let a woman learn, and that's the command. It sounds like it's a suggestion in the English, but in the Greek it's a command. And what Paul is getting at, I think, is that within the ancient world, the synagogue was a place where women could learn. Women and men sat and heard the word of God and participated in festivals and all of that stuff together, and so they learned the Bible. But the Gentiles didn't have anything like the synagogue, and they didn't have any real education system that would be set up for women to learn the Bible. And so I think what Paul is saying to Timothy is, you have got to correct that mistake. Women have to learn. And he goes on, I am not permitting a woman to teach. When you look at that, I am not permitting, I think that verb occurs about 17 times, roughly, in the New Testament. And it's almost always used in response to a previous question. And the person is asking, should we do this or not? And so it's a verb that is generally very contingent on the specifics of the question. So, for example, when my kids were little and they would ask me, hey, Mom, can I have a cookie? I might say to them, I'm not permitting you to have a cookie. Why? Because it's 4 in the afternoon and you'll ruin your supper, right? But I might say, oh, sure, I am permitting you to have a cookie. If it was 7 o'clock at night, they're getting ready for bed, they had a good dinner, okay, it's a nice treat. So, you see, the I am permitting is something that once the condition is realized, then it's fine. You can go ahead and do it. I don't permit something if the conditions aren't right. But once those conditions are met, then I will permit it. And so I think that I am not permitting a woman to teach is Paul saying, I think that they are teaching the wrong thing. So to correct that, we've got to make them learn. You've got to create a situation where, Timothy, where they can learn. I'm not permitting a woman to have to teach. And then you go to, or have authority over men. Now that word, have authority over, as how it's translated, is a word that we don't find anywhere else in the New Testament. And we only find it maybe a handful of times prior to the second century. It's a word that when it's used like a couple of times in Josephus, it's extremely negative. It's in the context of like a murder or something. I mean, it's the kind of, I take advantage of my authority to destroy. So it's not the neutral have authority over or authority, that term that you find exousia everywhere in the New Testament. This is a unique term, and it is a very negative term. If the women are teaching, like some of the men are, these Gnostic or these proto-Gnostic ideas about this creator God who's not the true God and the Genesis story that's not really a story about a fall but about actually seeing truth, you know, just upside-down stuff, if that's what's happening, then, and they're promoting Eve as this revealer of truth, then they really are promoting an idea where there's negative authority that's being promoted against men. And so it makes sense to me that Paul would want that to be stopped. Though, so he goes on to say, Adam was formed first and then Eve, and Adam wasn't deceived, but Eve was deceived. And to me, that is a direct challenge to the false teachings that are circulating there among men and women in the church in Ephesus. But to fix the problem for women, they have to learn. In chapter 1, to fix the problem with the men, they have to stop teaching, and they'll also learn. But there's a natural mechanism for them to learn. So when then you get to verse 15 and you have she will be saved through childbearing, it may be, and this is such a, it's a hard verse to understand, but I'm most persuaded by the understanding that Paul begins here to think about virtues. And in the ancient world, both Jews and Gentiles could talk about birthing virtues, whether it was a man or a woman. You could talk about developing and growing in your virtues and use the birth analogy to do that, which works beautifully, I think, for Paul here in chapter 2. So I think what he is saying is currently, right now, Timothy, you've got a problem on your hands. There are women who are teaching false ideas. So you have to teach them true ideas. When they have birthed the virtues that come from knowing the true gospel, faith and love and holiness, to me then the restriction is lifted and they'll be able to teach again.
Well, our caller actually drop, but I wasn't about to stop you because you were on a roll, you were doing great, and I'm guessing that that's probably not the first time you've heard that objection before.
Oh, yes, and I appreciate the complexity of this text, and I realize there are many who will disagree with me on the various points of exegesis and the way that, that this verse is lived out. And what I hope for is that we would continue to be able to have a good dialogue, valuing each other as brothers and sisters in Christ, both trying to develop our Christian virtues. And maybe, you know, for me, I'm the person that gives somebody else the practice of patience. I don't know, long-suffering. But anyway, I think, yeah, it's a very tough verse. I would say that for myself, it's not the place that I start in trying to understand how the Bible or how the New Testament looks at women, because it is such a difficult passage, just in and of itself, a difficult passage to know exactly what Paul is saying here. So I'd rather go to those passages that are more clear and start with them, and then come back to this passage that is a bit unclear.
Well, we're a bit overdue for a break. That's okay, but we're going to go ahead and take that break. And I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Lynn Kowick of Wheaton College. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. My guest this week is Lynn Kowick from Wheaton College, but next week, I said we're going to have someone come on who's going to be talking with us about the Dead Sea Scrolls and such. So if you're in here next week, you're in for a treat. Craig Evans is going to be my guest next week, talking about Jesus, Dead Sea Scrolls, and archaeology. I hope you'll be back for that. But for now, we're talking about women.
I'll certainly be listening, Nick. He's phenomenal, so I'll certainly be listening.
Yeah, he's an incredible guy, and I'm definitely looking forward to it, and thank you for saying you're going to be listening to as well. We're talking about women in the New Testament world of Lynn Kowick. Now, we start talking about something about Paul. Now, Paul sometimes gets a rap as a misogynist. Do you think that's accurate?
No, I don't think that he's a misogynist. No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why not?
Well, I think that he is trying to present the gospel message to situations that have very different views on morality, especially in his Gentile churches, as we talked about a little bit in the first hour. And so he's trying to present what a holy life looks like. And he's also... he's limited on what the options are for full expression of humans in his world. What I mean by that is the Greco-Roman world was highly stratified. Maybe some of your listeners have watched Downton Abbey, or they know Jane Austen novels, where you have people that are slotted in different, you know, are you a footman, are you a butler, are you a lord or lady or a duchess, or I get all confused with all this. But if you're in that world, you know that world, and you know where you plug in. And that was a very similar world to Paul. And he knew that that was a given. Right, so he's not going to be able to change that in the wider world. What he does try and do is make those lines of stratification go away when he's in the church, and he privileges the working of the Holy Spirit in each believer's life. So he is the one who says there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male and female. You're all one in Christ. And those aren't just words for Paul that he says to the Galatians, but he tries to live that out by saying to the Corinthian church that women are able to pray and prophesy. So that's public speech. This would be in 1 Corinthians 11. This is public speech in the church. Now that was for some people at this time, that would be shocking for women to speak publicly in that venue, especially if it was a slave woman. Should a slave woman speak and pray publicly in front of her owner, whether her owner was a woman or a man? I mean, that's very countercultural, if you will. And I think, but Paul insisted on that the Spirit and the Spirit's gifting take precedent over any kind of restriction that the society would put on. And yet, and here's where Paul has to thread the needle, he also doesn't want the church to look immoral to the outside world. And so he doesn't want the Corinthians or anyone else to kind of use this freedom to give the impression that the church is a free-for-all, you know, that they're anarchists. So that's the needle he has to thread, and that's where I think at times, just reading one or two verses out of Paul, you might get the impression that he's trying to push down women. But in fact, they have all the freedoms and responsibilities that anyone does, any man does in the church.
Well, I can already hear another critic who would want to say, well, how can they teach? Because when you go to 1 Corinthians 14, it says, as in all the congregations of the saints, women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission, as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in the church.
Yes. Yeah, and that comes right as Paul was talking about, Paul said in chapter 11 that women can pray and prophesy. So assuming that Paul is consistent, then he must mean something a little bit more narrow in chapter 14. He just got done talking about in chapter 14, right before your quotation, about prophets speaking and taking their turn and not interrupting and not being chaotic and not presenting chaos. He just, in the whole of chapter 14, is talking about how the church seems to be a chaotic place. They're speaking in tongues. Nobody knows what anybody else is saying. They're not together as a community. And it seems to me that passage then that you read, Paul is not saying that women in general can't speak and can't prophesy, because he just said in 11 that they are, that they're praying and prophesying in their church. So chapter 14, what I think is happening here is when the female prophet sort of gets out of line, if you will, as apparently some of the male prophets were as well, and also potentially being disruptive in their speaking out. At least that's what I take Paul to be saying when he says, ask your husbands at home. You know, when you look at the Gospels, let me just, if I could just put this in here briefly, because I think this gives us a window into the social world.
Sure.
A couple times in the Gospels, disciples will ask Jesus something privately. And the reason they do that is because if they had asked Jesus publicly, they would have been challenging his honor. Now, it's not for us in America, that wouldn't be the case. We're fine with raising our hands and saying to the teacher, could you repeat that, please? I'm not understanding. Okay, the teacher doesn't feel bad. Their teacher's not dishonored in any way. But in Jesus' day and in Paul's day, to directly question publicly your teacher was to potentially dishonor them. So when Nicodemus comes to Jesus and he comes at night, he's an honest seeker. But when you have a Pharisee or a scribe come during the day, hey, good teacher, how, you know, tell me about eternal life. And Jesus responds, well, what do you think good is? You know, he realizes that that man is challenging him. So when you have a situation where in the church in Corinth, a wife asks her husband something publicly, the chances that that could be perceived as dishonoring her husband are pretty high. She might respond and say, but look, it's I'm talking in the Spirit, and I'm being guided by the Spirit, and whatever. Okay, fine, but not everybody's going to see that. And so Paul is trying, as I say, to thread this needle of not having the church seem as though it just dishonors everyone and it's chaotic and all of that. So, okay, let's work with what we have. And women, because of their gifting in the Holy Spirit, can pray and can prophesy, but they're going to do it in such a way that it doesn't dishonor others in their midst. And I think that's basically what Paul is trying to accomplish there in 14.
I've also heard some commentators, like a Gordon Fee, have said that some people even think these verses are an interpolation.
Right, yes. And they do that for textual reasons. These verses are found in different places in chapter 14 in the copies that we have of the biblical text. So, yes, I mean, that is possible. And, of course, Gordon Fee believes in the authority of the Bible, absolutely. So he's not saying we should cut out bits and pieces we don't like. He's making
right.
this comment because of the textual evidence, right?
And there are some people I've heard who say that Paul isn't giving his position. He's giving an argument that the Corinthians were using, and then he's responding to that argument. What do you think about that possibility?
And that is absolutely a possibility, because he does that in other parts of the letter, for sure. So in chapter 6, it seems that Paul is quoting the Corinthians when he says, all things are lawful. And then he goes on to qualify it, but not all things are beneficial. One of our problems for us today in reading the biblical text is that when it was written, that they didn't have punctuation. They didn't have quotation marks. They didn't have those sorts of reading helps that we have today. In fact, they didn't even separate, didn't put a space between words. So they were just letters all strung together, and the reader had to sort out the words.
And then there's also a problem that we have that in the epistles, we're only getting one side of the conversation. So when we read, for instance, 1 Corinthians 7, it says, now for the matters that you asked about, and those of us on the other side are saying, geez, I wish we knew what those matters you asked about were. It'd make things so much easier.
That's so true. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Now, let's also go to another epistle where women seem to play a prominent role, and that's in Romans in the 16th chapter. The first woman to talk about is Phoebe, who's in fact described as a deaconess who delivers the letter itself. And if I'm correct, that would also mean she could be the one who read the letter and explained the letter, too.
That's right. And as I just noted, you can see why someone would need to explain the letter. These letters are written with all the words slid together on a page. It would be nice to have someone who knew what Paul was doing and where Paul was going and his ideas as they would read the letter to you. Yes, that's right. Phoebe is a deacon. Your translation may have made it in the feminine form, deaconess, but actually in the Greek it is deacon. And, yes, you're right. Paul asks that the church in Rome, who he's not met yet, he's hoping to meet them, that they would welcome Phoebe and help her. She has been a benefactor, protostis, benefactor, patron of his, and so he's praising her highly. I noticed that in your English, it is listed that she is a helper of many, and that's a very weak translation of this pretty common term. This term is regularly used of someone who is a benefactor.
Okay, before we move on to the second woman, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Lynn Cowick. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'd like to remind everyone that our show is indeed listener-supported through Blog Talk Radio, but also the Ministry of Deeper Waters itself is supported by people like you out there. And if you want to support what we're doing here, and we really do need your support, you can find out some details on my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. There's a donate button there. My ministry partner, J.P. Holding of Tectonics, you can go to him and say, hey, I want to support Deeper Waters. I want to support Nick Peters. And you can even go through Risen Jesus, Mike Lacona, my father-in-law's ministry. And finally, Ratio Christi Issues and Answers. I run that section. So, yes, I am a man of many hats. Such an always staying busy, but we could really use your support. So, please consider making a donation to Deeper Waters. Now, we've got Lynn Cowick here of Wheaton College talking about women in the New Testament. We just talked about Phoebe, a deaconess, and how she delivered the letter, but there's one who was kind of sparked a little controversy for quite a while, even wanting to change the text some because she was seen as unfavorable, and that was Junia, who's described by Eldon J. Epp as the first woman apostle. Would you care to explain what's going on with Junia?
Sure, sure. This would be, you could take a look at 16:7 there in Romans. You have Andronicus and Junia. Those are relatives or kinsmen, fellow prisoners with Paul. And they are notable among or prominent among the apostles. And so from the very earliest times, the church fathers and their comments on this, it was seen as remarkable that Paul would call a woman, Junia, would identify her as an apostle. And so in the Middle Ages, there was some fast work done on the text, and Junia became Junius, a man. So the woman gets changed to a man. But
well, first sex change ever, huh?
Exactly, yes, yes. And then when you have the more recent critical editions of the New Testament, where they go back and they look at all the manuscripts and evaluate everything, it became clear there's just absolutely no way that this word in Greek could have been a man's name. There's just absolutely no way. So then you started having conversations about whether among the apostles, or that particular preposition, whether that meant the apostles, a separate group, knew about Andronicus and Junia, and so among the apostles, that group, they really liked Andronicus and Junia, or whether Andronicus and Junia were actually members of this group of apostles. The Greek reads most naturally as the latter, that is, that they are members of apostles, of the group of apostles. So finally then, the argument is, well, what does Paul mean by apostle here? Does he actually mean, like himself, that kind of apostolic authority, or is it more like, well, they're like messengers or just co-workers, that kind of thing. And I think there would not have been any of this mental gymnastics, if you will, if it had been Fred and Tom, my kinsmen, you know, and fellow prisoners. No one would have been concerned at all that they were prominent among the apostles and that Paul meant apostles and all of that good stuff. The fact that it's a woman mentioned, that, because that upends a lot of tightly held ideas about what women can do in the church and what, or what they did in the first century church, you have a lot of gymnastics, I would say, with the biblical text here.
And what do you think is being said about Junia, that she's a woman apostle?
Well, I think that that she carried apostolic authority. I think that she and Andronicus perhaps had seen the Lord. That's the definition of apostle that we find given by Peter in Acts 1. Fellow Richard Bauckham has argued that perhaps this Junia is the same Joanna that we meet in Luke 8. I think it's an intriguing idea, but wherever you come down on that particular argument, I think the idea here is that these were this was a couple who were commissioned to proclaim the gospel with the kind of authority that other of the apostles had, and that's apparently what they did, and they suffered for it. They were fellow prisoners. They were, they walked the talk, so to speak.
When we're looking at passages in Paul, one other passage we should talk about is the Ephesians passage, where Paul writes about a woman should have full submission to a man, and so many women look on this passage and see Paul as dominating, anti-woman, patriarchal, things of that sort. What's going on in the Ephesians 5 passage?
Yes, and I can appreciate how that passage, 5:22, has been used, I think, wrongly. It's been yanked out of its context and used to further other social ends, not goals that Paul had at all. To really understand 5:22, you have to go up to 5:17, which is, don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. And that's actually the command. That's the verb that governs up through verse 22. So what does being filled with the Spirit look like? Well, it looks like singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and making music in your heart. And all of these other verbs are connected back to the be filled with the Spirit. And you get to 5:21, where Paul says, submit to each other out of reverence for Christ, or it could be translated submitting to each other. You know, again, be filled with the Spirit, submitting to each other out of reverence for Christ. And so you have Paul, that same verb, submitting to or be subject to each other. That verb is assumed then in 5:22, because in the Greek, in 5:22, it just says, wives to your husbands as to the Lord. There is no verb, which you're allowed to do in Greek. You're not so much allowed to do that in English, but Greek grammar allows you to do that. And so 5:21, submitting to each other out of reverence for Christ, wives to your husbands as to the Lord, that's how the passage needs to be read. So however wives and are submitting to husbands, that in some way is related to how anybody at the church should see everybody else or see themselves relative to everybody else. So that's one thing that I would suggest, that Paul is shaping the reality, the world reality, where honoring others is very important, but he never lets the honor of others supersede the person's responsibility to Christ. When you read further in this passage, in 5, and you have husbands love their wives, that's a command. And so it's not a command for women to submit to their husbands, wives to submit to your husbands. That's not in command form. As I mentioned, there's not even a verb. But in later in the passage, you have in verse 25, husbands love your wives. That is a command. That would have surprised in the sense of commanding it. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it was an ideal. People hoped that husbands and wives would love each other. But to command it the way Paul does, and then to frame that love as self-sacrificial, that's really the gospel coming through. That would not have been an expectation for Jewish or Gentile husbands at this time. And then let me just say very, very quickly, and I developed this idea more in my Ephesians commentary, but let me just note that as Paul goes down to the bottom of this passage here in bottom of chapter 5, he begins to talk about the two becoming one flesh. He talks about the body, the husband's body, and the wife's body, and how the husband should see the wife's body as his own body and thus care for it and love it, because the two are one flesh, quoting from Genesis. Now, to me, that opens up the idea of reciprocity. That is, what is good for one should be good for the other. And Paul doesn't develop that too much here in Ephesians, because he's also very interested to talk about the mystery of union of Christ and the church. And so the marriage union of husband and wife serves Paul's overall goal of showing how the church is united to Christ as body is united to head. That metaphor. So he uses that metaphor extensively to try and show unity. But the idea of reciprocity is brought out, I think, very clearly by Paul in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, where, again, he says the wife, I think it's in verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, which, of course, everybody knew. That's not saying anything fancy, right? And then Paul goes on, though, with a shocking statement. And the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And that would have shocked the hearers very much, because you don't have that kind of equality or reciprocity found in other Jewish writings or in Gentile writings. So for Paul, the marriage is one of mutual respect and mutual giving and putting the other before oneself. And I don't think Paul was interested in trying to reinforce the social hierarchy that was also the case in his day. He had to live with it, because that was the reality of the day. That was part of the legal code. But he wasn't trying to reinforce that in believers' lives or within the church.
And when we're reading the Ephesians passage, I think sometimes some people get caught up in the submission person. See what Paul says women should do. See what he says women should do. They get so angry about it. They don't look at all the things that the men, like myself, are commanded to do, because that is a very strong passage for men. But men have a whole litany of things they're supposed to do, and give the impression of, and by the way, when you stand before God, you're going to be called on account of how your whole family turned out. And then I tell people, when you get to the words, as Christ loved the church, if you're a married husband, you'd better be getting nervous at that point, because that is a very serious command.
That's so true. And I think the other thing to note here is that for Paul, the family isn't simply, or at least broadly speaking, in his day and age, the family wasn't simply husband and wife and children. It also included slaves and owners. And that's why in Ephesians, that's why actually every place that in the letters that marriage is talked about, you also have the mention of slavery, even in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, because in the ancient world, that's what the family was like. Well, of course, today, fortunately, we absolutely realize that we should not reinforce the institution of slavery, that it happened to be a reality in the biblical world, and so they had to address it. They had to tell people, how can you live with this as your reality? But they certainly weren't trying to say, this is what we should always have. And so I think when you realize that Paul is breaking down even the institution of slavery, which he does at the end of, or in the middle of Ephesians 6, I think it's verse 9, when he will say to the owners that they should be careful because both of you have the same master in heaven, and with him there is no partiality. So there's no favoritism with God. And that, of course, undercuts the whole institution of slavery, which was based on favoritism, of seeing the owner as better than the slave. But in this case, you have the apostle saying very clearly, we're not going to do that in church. And so I think he is trying to undercut the privilege that certain groups were given in the ancient world, such as husbands or slave owners, they could be women or men, and say within the church, you can't use that privilege.
Well, we should also discuss 1 Corinthians 7 a bit more, because some people say Paul is being anti-marriage in this passage and looking at marriage as a lesser state. What's going on in 1 Corinthians 7?
Yes, well, apparently the Corinthians, they have some really crazy ideas about how they should live their embodied life. They think it's okay for a man to have his father's wife, his stepmother. They think it's okay for the men in the group to go to prostitutes, but they're not sure that they should have sex within marriage. It's hard to pull all of those things that seem mutually exclusive, pull them together. But in some way, they're just very confused about how they should live. If I'm a spiritual being, then what do I do with my body? And Paul says, well, you're not totally a spiritual being. You're also an embodied being. And in fact, your body is going to be raised. It's going to be immortal. It's going to be imperishable. This is what he says in chapter 15. So your body goes with you, but in a immortal state. So what you do with it now really matters. So their immediate question then in chapter 7 revolves around sexual relations within marriage and whether that is an acceptable practice or whether they should be completely ascetic and forego any kind of sexual relations. Paul is not against marriage, and he certainly has good friends who are married, like Priscilla and Aquila. And what we just saw in Ephesians, he recognizes the importance of marriage. But he is also very concerned that the Corinthians understand themselves first and foremost as disciples of Christ. And so he doesn't want them to marry just because it's the acceptable thing to do, but he wants them to think long and hard about how their marriage will help further their calling in God's kingdom. And he wants them to be bold that if they come to the conclusion that they're better able to serve God as single people, that they should be okay with that, and that the community, the church itself, should support that very radical decision. Because, as you mentioned at the beginning of the first hour, it was pretty typical for people to marry. I mean, most everyone married at least once at this time. So Paul is suggesting they could live like a prophetic life, like a John the Baptist, where, you're wholeheartedly called there to preach, perhaps to travel, like Paul did. And so he wants to make space for that. He's not saying you shouldn't marry or that marriage is less, but rather just trying to give the other side of it, not have them just sort of reflexively think, oh, I got to marry.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back after this to start wrapping things up. My guest is Lynn Kellogg, talking about women in the New Testament. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI.
And you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show. Free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back. My guest is Lynn Kerwick. We're talking about women in the world of the New Testament. And as we're wrapping things up, we should probably start moving on to see what happened after the time of Paul. And you've written a lot on the patristics and such. What's the general attitude you see towards women after the time of Paul?
Yes, well, I think what you have in the second and third centuries is a rise in martyrdom as the church undergoes its period of persecution. And in that arena, if I could make that pun, men and women both paid the ultimate price for their faith. And we have stories about this. Perpetua, probably the most famous story of a martyr. We have a document that I think could, it claims to be her diary, and I think there's a good historical case to be made that that is in fact true. We have her writing about the time right before she goes into to face the wild beasts, and she ponders her calling, and so we have, and she's highly praised for that ultimate commitment. And there are other women who are martyrs. So in that sense, I think the church didn't see male and female when it came to martyrs. They saw believers willing to give their lives. And so in that sense, there was strong equality. Where you would have potentially a growing inequality would be in the way the church began to structure itself in terms of bishops and the hierarchy. Because there you did not have, there was no women bishops. And so if that's going to be the yard mark, if you're going to use the growing magisterium as the yard marker for what women were doing in these early centuries, then you would conclude that they really were marginal to the growth of the church. But you've got to actually look further than that. You've got to consider all the evidence. When you look at all the evidence, like the martyrs, like some of the other writings that show how women maybe used their wealth to support the needy, and all kinds of things, you find that women were extremely involved and their contributions were highly valued in the growth of the church.
I also heard before that women were highly involved in the rise of Christianity, that women were exceptionally drawn to the Christian message.
Well, yes, I mean, that certainly is the argument made by some pagans that Christianity is just a religion of slaves and women, and there may actually be some historical truth to that jab, in as much as it didn't have a lot of social cachet, and so those who are needy embraced the gospel message. That was certainly true in Jesus's own time. There were enough wealthy women. I don't know. The kind of thing that women were drawn to Christianity as though they had something lacking that Christianity gave them is one model or one way of asking the question about why women were drawn to Christianity. That sort of methodology has also been challenged a little bit because it's so hard for us to know, unless the person in the ancient world tells us, why they were drawn to Christianity. And my own thought is that I think the message of the gospel is appealing to those who are searching for God. And as Jesus said, the way is narrow. And there's not going to be a flood of people who are going to want to commit to this gospel message. But for those that do, I'm here. And I think you have both men and women who were just spiritually sensitive and were drawn to the gospel, and they were welcomed in the church in those early centuries.
You've written some about Tertullian also, and I think he kind of had a very high aesthetic view of marriage.
Yes.
And for even her the ultimate form of virginity was to be married and still practice virginity. Is that accurate?
You know, I'm not positive if that was Tertullian's view or not, but you are reflecting a concern that the church had at this time of whether you could have a married couple who decided that they would not have marital relations. The church grew very uncomfortable with that setup because they were concerned that situation might come up. The husband gets sick, he's laying in his bed, the wife is caring for him as a nurse does, but then their romantic feelings are rekindled and one thing leads to another. So they say, you know, to try and do a marriage without having sexual relations is probably not the best way to go forward. So the church was trying to wrestle through that. And you're right to point out that during the second and third centuries, there became an increasing interest in asceticism or living very sparsely, not with acts, you know, a lot of excesses. And that continued to influence the church. It's not something I think that you find in Paul, but you can interpret Paul and do some other things in such a way that then you would have a church that strongly emphasizes asceticism.
Now, as we're wrapping things up here, we've only got a little under 14 minutes left. Let's suppose there was this critic out there who's a female critic and says, I don't really like the way the Bible treats women as a whole. I don't like the way that the New Testament writes about women and such. I mean, you've said a lot here. What would be your general advice to someone who's concerned about supposed sexism in Christianity?
Yes, well, I think they are perceiving accurately the patriarchal culture of the New Testament time. It is the case that during the time of the New Testament, that it was a patriarchal world, and it would be silly for me to deny that. So they're picking up on something that is accurate. Where I would ask them to think more deeply about is whether the New Testament is condoning that patriarchy. That's where I think, no, the New Testament is not condoning that. The New Testament speaks against it. But it does so within the parameters of what makes sense for the first century world. So there's nothing in the Bible about plane travel because there wasn't any plane travel. There's nothing in it about you should go out and vote, you know, for the president because there was no such thing as that kind of political system. So I think we have to be fair, if you will, to the reality that this document was a real, these were real letters and real treatises that were sent to real people who were going to try and live out their faith in their real context. And so in one sense you could say it's a wonderful blessing that they are so particular because it affirms then our own particularity. It means that God really cares about our own world that has plane travel and representative democracy, that the gospel can speak as real into our situation as it did in the first century. We don't have to recreate the patriarchy of the first century. I don't think the Bible asks us to do that. But it does promise us that no matter what situation we're in, the gospel is sufficient, and it can give us fullness of life.
Since we're talking some now about the gospel as well, I spoke at the start of the show about how far women have come in the world, such you're even teaching at a university and being a recognized speaker. Do you think, what role do you think Jesus and Christianity played in bringing all of this about?
Well, I think that the church has always allowed for, or let me say it in the, let me start it this way. The Holy Spirit has continued to guide the church over these hundreds and hundreds of years. And he's done so in a way that we see reflected in the book of Acts and in the epistles, namely that women are praying and prophesying, that women have gifts, including gifts of leadership that they can exercise, that they are living into their faith and accepting the call to be faithful disciples. And when you have that, when you have the power of the Holy Spirit unleashed in women disciples, you're going to have a society that sees the value in women. So I think that while it took a long time for women to get the vote, for example, while it took a long time for women to be accepted at universities, in fact, they are. And part of it is, I think, because they do carry the idea is they are made in the image of God, and they are full members in the church. And so I think it's those foundational ideas that at the end of the day are recognized.
Yeah, we sometimes forget that. Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, but that was really such a great shaping verse, and it's been a verse that's broken down several barriers today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And then you also, you see the women that, like what we've talked about, the Mary and the Martha. We didn't talk about Prisca and Aquila, but Priscilla or Prisca, and the fact that she taught Apollos there in the book of Acts. She's talked about in Acts 18 and a couple of other places, or Yoda and Syntyche, who are mentioned in Philippians 4. You have women, they're all throughout the New Testament. They're doing things.
We could also include the household of Chloe.
Exactly. Yes, they're doing, I mean, they're just standing side by side with their male fellow believers and co-workers, and God is building his church through them. And so I think that, you know, that builds, and it's a testimony. And, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, Amy Carmichael. I'll be talking about her in a class I'm doing this coming week. And, you know, an amazing faithful woman missionary who stands right alongside other faithful male missionaries. You know, it's like God will just charge ahead, and men and women are invited to...
Speaking of missionaries, we can say, also remember that the first witnesses to the resurrection, the most important event in history, were women.
That's exactly right, yes. And I think we need to reinforce that more. That shows Jesus was very affirming of a woman's voice.
And what would you say to a woman today who's wanting to learn more about her Bible and about Christianity?
Well, certainly in the United States, she has so many opportunities to learn, and I would encourage her to do so, and to ask some bold questions, to think about where God would like you to serve. And I have to say that at times, someone may think in hearing this that what I mean is you should go like Amy Carmichael to another culture, or I would maybe they think I'm saying you should go and get your PhD like I have. But actually, I think at times God calls us to incredible obedience in ways that are not seen as the success, so to speak, of the wider world. In other words, maybe he would call a woman disciple to be very faithful to her aging father or mother, and that's where she pours her life, or to, in a volunteer sense, to either the elderly or perhaps to those with special disabilities. In other words, I'm not saying that your desire for deeper service to God would need to be expressed in ways that seem sensational or public, but just trust that God will use the gifts that he's given you, and don't be shy. Don't sell yourself short. Make sure that you trust God and step out.
Okay, we've got just a little over 5 minutes left, so let's kind of try and just wrap things up. What's the message that you would really like to leave behind for the Deeper Waters audience?
And so as I was working on my book on women in the Hellenistic period here in the early centuries, women in the world of the earliest Christians, what I realized was that while I was trying to figure out what women were doing, what I kept coming up against is that it wasn't just women. I had to think of wealthy women or poor women. I had to think of Gentile women or Jewish women. I had to think of women who lived in the town or who lived in the rural setting. In other words, I couldn't just see women over against men, but I had to see the figure of woman in a much more complex way. And one of the things that I realized was that women could be very influential in terms of their patronage, in terms of their wealth and giving their wealth in the service of others. And so when we hear things like, oh, women just stayed at home in the ancient world, or, oh, women never talked in the ancient world, or there's some truth in that that's the sort of official line and the rhetoric of the day. But when you look deeper, you see women were doing all kinds of things and were influencing their world in all different kinds of ways, including with their wealth. And so Mary Magdalene and Joanna, the wife of Cusa, gave out of their own resources to help the disciples and to help Jesus' ministry. And so what I came to see is that there were women all over the place, in public and in various settings. In what I would love for readers of the New Testament to do is, as they're reading the Bible, to populate the pages with men and women active in the marketplace, active in the church, active all around them, so that they begin to imagine also themselves as participating in this wonderful redemptive story that is ours through Christ. That's what I would hope that readers would take away.
Well, I'd like to thank you for being my guest today. I certainly hope you've enjoyed your time on here, and I hope we'll see you again sometime.
Thank you very much, Nick. I enjoyed it.
And I'd like to remind everyone of you before we leave that Dr. Kerwick has certainly said she's going to be listening next week, because Craig Evans is going to be my guest, and I think we're going to have an excellent show. So tune in next week. For now, I'm Nick Peters for Deeper Waters Podcast, signing off until next week.